Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear very well back there? Okay, good. So, this morning before the talk, I'd like to dedicate any merit generated from this teaching to our ancestors, our Buddha ancestors, our family ancestors, the native people that lived here before our ancestors did, and our teachers, our grandparents. Just honor them today. And you notice I put an offering on the altar this morning, and that is some soup. Thank you to Bill. Wherever Bill is. Oh, he isn't here. And some water for the hungry spirits. So I'm going to talk about that a little today. Do you all have programs? Or enough of you to share later on? You'll need that program later on. So, we'll share. So this talk today is going to be about bodhisattvas, how bodhisattvas see themselves, what they believe, what they do, with reference to the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and especially, specifically the Diamond Sutra, which is what a group of us are reading together and discussing on Tuesday mornings. Yeah, so the Prajnaparamita literature and the vow of the Bodhisattva are key to the Mahayana perspective, point of view, worldview, our worldview in Zen as a practice tradition in Buddhism. Hi. And I'm also going to speak about Sengaki, which is a Japanese Zen Buddhist ceremony for dedicating the merit and comforting the hungry ghouls. And it's most often in America observed today on the 31st of October. Coincides with the other pagan and Christian celebrations that All Saints Day, All Hallows Eve. Did you know that Halloween was a Christian tradition? That it came from the Catholic tradition? Yeah, I guess I didn't know that. That was new to me.
All Saints Day.
Right, but also Halloween. It morphed into Halloween.
All Hallows Eve.
Yes, that's one name for it. Yes. And in England, they celebrate Guy Fawkes Day. So, it's for those who are already dead, for those who don't know they're dead, who are dead and don't know they're dead, who are wandering. So, in ancient times, people would dress up. It was called guising as evil spirits, and that was to protect themselves against the wandering spirits that were out on that night and would want to mess with them, you know, get to their bodies. So it's really probably based on fear, but it turns that fear on its head by looking scarier than the evil spirits that are out there wandering around. So many of our religious going back to spiritual and religion, so many of our rites and rituals seem to be in response to our fear as human beings. Prayers, rituals, mantras, right? Petitionary prayers. Please help, or bring me some of this, you know. I'm a hungry ghost, poor me. Please, universe, God, wherever it is, help me. Because we fear that we're so small and vulnerable. That's a fear we have, one of our fears. So first I want to thank Guy Gibbon, because he has some wonderful primers, he calls them, that are on the website that you can all look at. And after this talk, if you're interested, you can go on and read his primer, which is brief but very dense, about the Diamond Sutra. So it's the shortest version of the Prajna. No, it's not. It's called the Prajnaparamita in 300 verses. The shortest version is what we chant every day here, the Heart Sutra. That's the shortest version, because there are versions in 8,000 lines. Let's see. I don't know what the other numbers are. They get bigger and bigger. 100,000 lines. That's one. So they're said to sum up the most important of the Buddha's teachings, at least according to the Mahayana. And they're essential. It's essential for three reasons. One is it transforms how we perceive reality. The Prajnaparamita Sutras transform how we perceive reality. It also relates how a bodhisattva who understands emptiness can help those who are not yet awakened. Three, it presents the path to Buddhahood, and thus it's considered to be the most important wisdom text to prefigure the Zen tradition. It's memorized, recited, and copied in Asian countries, has been for 1,500 years. And the translation by Kumarajiva is considered to be quite good. It was there was a copy of it discovered in some caves in China, and it was dated 863. So it predates the first known written text, the Gutenberg Bible. Can you imagine? That's old. So that's important, you know, in religious traditions. We want to make sure that everyone knows this is the real stuff, and we have documents to prove it. Isn't that true of all religions? Traditions, and Zen is part of a religious tradition. So that's important, right? So there are three phases of understanding referred to in this. One is form. So mountains are mountains. And two is emptiness. Mountains are not mountains. And three is mountains are mountains again. And those two perspectives are reconciled in the understanding of a bodhisattva, the practice of a bodhisattva. It's the third way. To think more practically about skillful ways of approaching our own liberation and liberating others. It's a more practical way. In a world, and I'm quoting Guy's writing here on the website, in a world whose full nature we don't comprehend, approaching the mystery beyond what we call it, beyond what our names for it are, God, universe, mystery, whatever we don't understand out there, which is a lot, actually. It's a lot. So in this sutra, Buddha's intent is to relieve the beings, all beings of suffering, not to expound a philosophical treatise. So I'm going to read a little bit from the sutra. On my last talk, I read from the beginning of this sutra. And this sutra is a dialogue between the Buddha and Subhuti, one of his main guys who was known for his understanding of emptiness. trouble is, he gets caught there. He gets caught there, and Buddha's trying to help him to go beyond that perspective, which is also considered to be the perspective of an arhat, whose intent, according to this, is to free themselves, get off the wheel of life and death and suffering, and not come back again. That's it, end of story. Whereas the bodhisattva vow is to keep coming back to this world of suffering and contribute in a positive way to it. So here's what Buddha is saying to Subhuti about those who had set out on the bodhisattva path. The Buddha said to him, Subhuti, those who had now set forth on the bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. However many beings there are in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they're born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? Subhuti, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a self or who creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul. So, a bodhisattva has no perception of themselves as a bodhisattva. That sounds kind of hard, doesn't it? Do you think so? I find that to be hard. I'm constantly thinking about bodhisattvas because I'm a Zen teacher and because I'm always reading and because I'm here listening to other Zen teachers give talks. So it's pretty hard not to hold on to a perception of a being or a self or a bodhisattva. So, isn't it true, though, that we congratulate ourselves when we do something good? I mean, it's very subtle. We might not think we're doing it, but it's almost automatic. And the other morning in the study group, I found myself doing that. I talked about how someone came up to my car window, came up and knocked on my window of my car in the parking lot of the Office Max, and my first response was, what? And it was a woman, and she, she's like, roll your window down, so I did, and she said, do you have any money, because I'm homeless and I'm pregnant and I'm staying at the shelter, but they kick you out at 7:30 every morning, And I'm really hungry. And I said, well, I have no cash, but I'll buy you lunch. And she said, great. So we just drove over to the Subway, and I got her a big lunch and gave her a ride to the bus stop. And then I came to my group and told them about it. And in the middle of telling them about it, I realized, oh, wow. This is really a trip. This is exactly what we all got to see, that in action, Just couldn't resist telling somebody about it, right? Or I would have told myself over and over again, probably, even if I didn't tell them. So that's, we build up this idea of merit, that we're becoming a good person. And in Buddhism, this early Buddhism, they called this a body of merit. And in the Diamond Sutra, and in our meal chants for our formal retreats, we chant the names of the different bodies of the Buddha. So the Nirmanakaya is the physical, visible body of the Buddha, which supposedly has 32 marks, which is how you can recognize this physical body, that this is Buddha. And then the merit body is called the Sambhogakaya. That's also called the body of ease or bliss or enjoyment body. And reflecting on it, I was thinking, you know, it makes sense that Sambhogakaya would be called both body of merit and body of ease and enjoyment, because if we're reflective, if we're practicing Shila, one of the six perfections, the six paramitas that I'm going to talk some more about, we're practicing that, and we're practicing ethics, and we're practicing meditation and reflection, it's easier to feel ease. It's easier to feel enjoyment. A lot easier than if we're not doing that, if we're creating a lot of negative karma and sitting with that, right? So that's what I thought about that. So this body of merit, we want to confirm our identity as a good person, a good Buddhist. Has anyone ever said to any of you, "Wow, you're a real good Buddhist"? Well, if they haven't yet, just wait. The longer you practice, the more people you let know that you're doing this practice. Eventually, it'll happen. If it doesn't, then I want to make some offerings to you. And do some bows, full bows. So let me read a little bit here about what Buddha says to Subuddhi about merit. Moreover, Subuddhi, when bodhisattvas give a gift, dana, they should not be attached to a thing. When they give a gift, they should not be attached to anything at all. They should not be attached to a sight when they give a gift. Nor should they be attached to a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch. Does this sound familiar? Or a dharma when they give a gift. Thus, the Buddha, fearless bodhisattvas, should give a gift without being attached to the perception of an object. And why? Subuddhi, the body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give a gift without being attached is not easy to measure. What do you think, Subuddhi? Is the space to the east easy to measure? He says, no, it's not. Bhagavan, likewise, the south, the west, the north, in between, above, below, behind, sideways. And Subuddhi, of course, says, no, it's not, Bhagavan. So it is, Subuddhi. The body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give a gift without being attached is not easy to measure. Thus, Subuddhi, those who set forth on the bodhisattva path should give a gift without being attached to the perception of an object. So he's basically unpacking what is dana. What is dana paramita? It's giving a gift without attachment to the gift, to the attributes of the gift, to anything about the gift. A physical gift he's talking about now. And later on it goes into describing jewels and things that would be considered great merit-producing gifts. Then he talks about the possession of attributes, you know, like the Buddha's 32 marks, and how it's an illusion. And that by means of attributes that are no attributes, the Tathagata, which is a name for Buddha, can indeed be seen. So this is how this dialectic goes. Because a bodhisattva has no perception of being a bodhisattva is a bodhisattva. So there's a bodhisattva, there's no bodhisattva, and there is a bodhisattva. And it goes like that. Then he says, Subuddhi, fearless bodhisattvas do not cling to a dharma, much less to no dharma. This is the meaning behind the Tathagata's saying, A Dharma teaching is like a raft. If you should let go of Dharmas, how much more so no Dharmas? He needs to repeat this to Subhuti, because Subhuti is attached to no Dharmas, no self, emptiness. So there's a lot of repetition. So throughout this, he uses this dialectic with Subhuti to free him of concepts, including emptiness, self, body of merit, perfection, and enlightenment. A fearless bodhisattva is one who can hear these teachings of emptiness and the emptiness of emptiness without dying of fear. Apparently, Buddha was very worried that, you know, people would, and there actually was some people, according to the stories, who just had a heart attack and died on the site, you know, upon hearing about the teaching. So how to accept the birthless, deathless nature of all phenomena is the job of Bodhisattva to awaken to see, accept, and awaken to, and share. And share. The Buddha goes on to say that there are gifts that are no gifts, but certain no gifts are better than other no gifts. And that the no gift of sharing the teaching of through one's body and manner is probably the best gift. He does say that. And the way to liberation for the bodhisattva is to liberate others. That's it. And the word perfection is mentioned over and over again. That phrase from the Heart Sutra. Complete, unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment is unpacked in the Diamond Sutra. So complete, perfect enlightenment. I know of at least one person in this room who really hates that phrase, is very irritated by it. So, are there any others of you? Is it hard to recite that when you recite the Heart Sutra? Do you think, well, there's no such thing as complete, perfect enlightenment? That's it. End of story. Apparently, but what the Buddha says in the Diamond Sutra is that, you know, there's nothing to attain, that we've already got it. We've already got it, so we can't attain it. And the Buddha says, here. It's like, you are it, it already is you. You aren't it, it already is you. That's the perspective here about complete, perfect enlightenment. And it's also associated with prajna itself, with the sutra itself, that is what it is. It gets around that whole thing of you or anyone else having to take that on. I must achieve complete, unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. So the way of the bodhisattva. Well, let me read a little bit about what he says to him about perfection. Oh. First, I want to read you this. This is the Buddha talking to Subhuti about. He's getting at Subhuti again, and lifting up the sutra, a four line gatha or verse from this sutra, being pretty great. So the Buddha said, furthermore, Subhuti, if a man or woman renounced their self-existence every day, as many times as there are grains of sand in the Ganges and renounced their self-existence in this manner for as many kalpas. That's a really long period of time, kalpa. As there are grains of sand in the Ganges, and someone grasped but one four-line gatha of this Dharma teaching and made it known and explained it to others, the body of merit produced as a result of that would be immeasurably, infinitely greater. So he's saying, you know, you can say no self, no self, no self, emptiness, all day long, for kalpas, but just understanding four lines of the sutra is immeasurably, infinitely greater. So as a result of this, he also asks him, Subhuti, what do you think? Can the Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one, be seen by means of the 32 attributes of a perfect person? Subhuti says, no, indeed, Bhagavan. The Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one, cannot be seen by means of the 32 attributes of a perfect person. And why not? Because, Bhagavan, what the Tathagata says are the 32 attributes of a perfect person, Bhagavan. The Tathagata says are no attributes. Thus are they called the 32 attributes of a perfect person. That's when he tells him you can talk emptiness all day for kalpas, and it's still not as good as just understanding fully four lines. By the force of this dharma, the Venerable Subhuti was moved to tears. You had to be there. Wiping his eyes, he said to the Buddha, how remarkable, Bhagavan, how most remarkable, Sugata, is this Dharma teaching, that the Bhagavan speaks for the benefit of those beings who seek the foremost of paths, for the benefit of those who seek the best of paths, and from which my own awareness is born. Bhagavan, I have never heard such a teaching as this. This shall be the most remarkably blessed of bodhisattvas. They shall be who hear what is said in this sutra and give birth to a perception of its truth. And then he says, and how so, Bhagavan? A perception of its truth is no perception of its truth. Thus does the Tathagata speak of a perception of its truth as a perception of its truth. So, you get the picture, right? You're getting the picture of how this dialogue is going and how this dialectic is unfolding, and how it doesn't allow us to land anywhere, and how it unpacks and all the ideas of the early Buddhists. Do you ever feel like it's really impossible to listen deeply, just as a regular person, much less a bodhisattva, to the cries of the world? Yeah, I do. My heart is breaking open with what's happening in the world right now. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. That's all right. You know? I would rather have my heart be breaking open than be shut down and closed off and in my little box of fear. You know, all the things you see out there that are related to aggression of beings against other beings, or corporate entities against beings, is related to grasping based on fear. So this piece about being a fearless bodhisattva is key. A fearless bodhisattva is not afraid to let their heart break open. And with this practice of gate-gate, paragate, going beyond our current understanding, going beyond our current views, going beyond our constantly going beyond, letting go of what we think we know now, opening, letting go, opening constantly through that practice, a bodhisattva learns fearlessness. A bodhisattva is able to respond, finds a way to respond to the cries of the world, finds a way. Discernment comes with it. Discernment comes with this practice. So if you feel sometimes like you can't do it, like I'm not up to this bodhisattva vow thing, I can't listen to all this pain that's in the world, then, you know, go to a Dharma mentor, a Dharma buddy, someone, and just tell them that. Just tell them that. Just share that. Most likely, they'll say, oh, I understand. I feel that way too sometimes. You know, that's really hard. And maybe they'll say, so why don't you listen to yourself? Why don't you listen to your own cries for a while? Why don't you listen deeply to your own pain? Because when we do that, we get to the point where we can then let go. And sometimes talking to someone else helps me to let go. You know, just sharing it with someone else. One time I went to a retreat at Green Gulch, and I was so lonely there. I was just like, you know, this isn't Minnesota anymore. And I felt really lonely. And I went to this Dharma talk before the retreat started that Reb Anderson gave, Tenshin Roshi. And he said, as part of his talk, he said, you know, if you feel lonely, you should just tell someone about it. I couldn't believe it. It was like, wow. And so I did. After the talk, there was a tea with, you know, like we have, and there was a nice young couple there, and I said, hi, I'm from Minnesota, and I'm here for a retreat in the sesshin, and I'm feeling really lonely. They were like, oh, and I'm sorry, you know, and I felt better immediately. Sometimes it's so simple. So simple. Okay, so another reading. This is probably the last one. Because he's getting into the six paramitas now. Paramita means perfection. He says now to Subhuti, those beings shall be most remarkably blessed, Subhuti, who are not alarmed, not frightened, and not distressed by what is said in this sutra. And how so, Subhuti? What the Tathagata proclaims as the best of perfections is in truth no perfection. Moreover, Subhuti, what the Tathagata proclaims as the best of perfections is also proclaimed by countless Buddhas and Bhagavans. Thus, it is called the best of perfections. So too, Subhuti, is the Tathagata's perfection of forbearance, no perfection. Forbearance, patience. And how so? Subhuti, when King Kali cut off my limbs, he's talking about a previous life, my ears and nose and my flesh, at that moment I had no perception of a self, a being, a life, or a soul. I had neither perception nor no perception. And why not? At that moment, Subhuti, if I had had the perception of the self, at that moment I would have also had the perception of anger. Or if I had had the perception of a being, the perception of a life, or the perception of a soul, at that moment I would have had the perception of anger. And how so, Subhuti? I recall the 500 lifetimes I was the mendicant Kshanti, and during that time I had no perception of a self. Shanti is the word for patience. And during that time, I had no perception of a self, nor did I have the perception of a being, a life, or the perception of a soul. Therefore, Subhuti, fearless bodhisattvas, should get rid of all perceptions in giving birth to the thought of unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Giving birth to the thought of enlightenment is, that's bodhicitta. That's bodhicitta. That's what we want to have happen. Just to give birth to the thought of enlightenment. So, this is important. So if you're a bodhisattva who works, who is trying to respond to the cries of the world, and you become angry, like I did the other day because I felt anger at something that was happening that was unjust in the world. And immediately I could see, you know, this anger is mine, and I need to care for this anger, which means not dumping it out there. Although I did a tiny bit. I expressed it in an online comment to a public official. And then I thought, oh, geez, you can't do that. Or, you know, you have to do it skillfully, you know. I think it was fairly skillful. It wasn't really terrible. It wasn't a real blah kind of expression of anger. But, you know, one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh teaches especially is caring for our anger. You know, it's not that we won't have it, but it will come up. And then we know. We're attached to this self, this being, this world being a certain way, which it isn't always the way we would like it to be. You know, so the Buddha's saying, hey, if I had... It seems crazy, you know, like how could anyone really be, you know, letting go when their flesh is being carved up like this story here, but... There are Tibetan monks that went through torture who actually just used the power of their practice to generate compassion for this horrible state of mind of those who were torturing them. So this is actually not that far-fetched. So practicing the perfections that are in the Diamond Sutra, which are no perfections at all, with no self and nothing to attain, should you should breathe a sigh of relief now. And let go of 100 years and walk innocent, as it says in the Song of the Grass Roof Heritage. That's really the only way. Because if you fight, you know, to be a bodhisattva. It's not that kind of warrior. It's a different kind of warriorship. So, when we do the 49-day service for people who've died, the doshi goes up. First there's an echo, which is beautiful, and I can't remember it. I wish I could remember it. But Bonnie does. Yeah, it's a lovely kind of thing. Your great life has suddenly come to an end. And then the doshi goes up and snaps their fingers and says, free, strong like diamond, free, free. And he says it 3 times, strong like diamond. Free. Free. Or strong as diamond. So that's the diamond of the Diamond Sutra. The diamond that cuts through delusion. The diamond that helps us go home. Go home. Go to the oneness. Liberation. Free ourselves. free of confusion, regrets, heaviness. Go in peace, but vigorous. So at this time of year, there's this offering. We give an offering, some food that's easy to digest, some water for those who suffer, those who are ill, especially those who wander, restless, hungry, confused, for those who are in the hell realms. This is based on the story, and it's also morphed into a practice of acknowledging karma, thus freeing ourselves of its effect on our bodies, minds, and spirits, our hearts, so we don't have such a heavy heart. So, and this is based on the story of another disciple of the Buddha who used to be into the arts of esoteric arts, Magdalena. Magdalena had a dream of his mother, and his mother was suffering in a hell realm. She had died, and he went to the Buddha and said, I need to do something for my mother. You know, she's suffering. So the Buddha told her to do this ceremony, told him to do this ceremony for her. And so apparently he was able to go down, or wherever it is, hell, to this hell realm, and minister to his mother, feed his mother, pacify her restless spirit. And he asked that he do it on the same day that the monks were doing their regular repentance ceremony. So in that way, the Buddha helped Magdalena to let go. You might say he was fused with his mother. That's what we would say nowadays. He needed to individuate. Mm-hmm. He had all this regret. Maybe it was about being a home leaver and leaving her behind. Maybe it was, who knows, things he didn't say, didn't do, whatever. You can imagine from your own life, right? So this is great. Buddha gave Magdalena this chance to free himself, you know, to release himself through ministering to his mother in the hell realms. And he became a bodhisattva like Jizo Bodhisattva, who would go to the hell realms and minister to other people suffering there. So what do you think? Do you think he was healed of his attachment and distress by this bodhisattva practice? You think that's possible?
Probably not.
Well, I respect your opinion. So I want to have a poem to read you about letting go of the dead by Bill Holm, who's an Icelandic Minnesota writer. And here it is. Let go of the dead now. The rope in the water, the cleat on the cliff, do them no good anymore. Let them fall, sink, go away, become invisible as they tried so hard to do in their own dying. We needed to bother them with what we called help. We were the needy ones. The dying do their own work with tidiness. Just the right speed, sometimes even a little satisfaction. So quiet down, let them go. Practice your own song now. So one last thing before you can be free here. That verse on your program. I'd like to invite whoever would like to, only those who would like to join me in learning this. It's a song, and it was put to music by Krishna Das, and you can find it on YouTube, and you can probably find it on a link to it on Roshi Bernie Glassman's website. I think his website is called the Zen Peacemaker Order. And so we can learn this call and response, okay? And if you don't have the words, you could go la 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 or something. Or you can share with your neighbor. So I'll sing and you sing back to me, and then we'll try to do it again. Okay. We'll do one verse at a time that way. So I'll sing, you sing back, you sing back, sing back. Then we sing the whole thing together, the first verse, and then the second one we do the same. How about that? Okay, so this is an offering. It goes with the Singaki thing. This is often sung at lunchtime, which I'm getting close to, so. Calling all you hungry ghosts, calling all you hungry ghosts, everywhere through endless time, everywhere through endless time. You who wander, you who thirst, you who wander, you who thirst, I offer you this Bodhi mind. I offer you this Bodhi mind. Now the whole thing. Calling all you hungry ghosts, everywhere through endless time, you who wander, you who thirst, I offer you this Bodhi mind. Calling all you hungry spirits, calling all you hungry spirits, all the lost and the left behind, all the lost and the left behind. Calling all you hungry hearts, calling all you hungry hearts, everywhere through endless time. Everywhere, endless time. Gather round and share this meal. Gather round and share this meal. Your joy and your sorrow, I make it mine. Your joy and your sorrow, I make it mine. Calling all you hungry spirits, all the lost and the left behind. Calling all you hungry hearts, everywhere through endless time. Gather round and share this meal, your joy and your sorrow, I make it mine. Okay. Thank you for doing that with me.